lovers. I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novel Atomic Anna, and you're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Check This Out is a series where I interview emerging and diverse authors you may not have discovered yet. A series brought to you by New Hampshire Public Radio and our brand new partner, the Penn Faulkner Foundation. Penn Faulkner administers major literary awards and public programs, including the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. We have a lot of really exciting books and authors coming your way this spring. Next week, I talk to Julie Iromagna about her book, A Season of Light. Tune in next week for that interview. Today on my show, my guest is Callan Wink, and we are discussing his brand new novel, Beartooth. Beartooth is set on the fringe of Yellowstone in a corner of Montana where survival is never certain. The book focuses on two brothers, isolated, living off the grid. They're drowning in debt, and they come up with a wild, crazy way to dig out of this hole. In a sense, this novel is about a grand caper, the ultimate score, but that's not really what I'd say it's about. The seasons, the mountains, the wilderness, the grandeur of the American West are characters in this novel as much as the brothers themselves. This book opened my eyes to a piece of the West that I'd never seen or imagined. It was brutal and gorgeous, and my heart broke for the brothers in this novel and the choices they faced. In some ways, their world was as wide open as Montana's spectacular views, and in others, they were as limited as the decaying cabin they lived in. Callan Wink unveils unflinching darkness and a glimmer of hope, just enough to keep me reading and reading. Callan Wink, I'm so excited that you're here on Check This Out today so we can discuss your brand new, beautiful novel, Beartooth. Welcome to New Hampshire Public Radio.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Callan, this book is really as much about the land and a way of life as it was about two brothers trying to survive. And so when people ask me what it's about, I'm not sure which way to go. So I wanted to start by asking you, what is this book about? How do you describe it when people ask you what Beartooth is about?
You know, that's a good question. I think if it's about any one thing, I would say that at least while I was writing it, I was pretty interested in sort of how family ties can be constrictive, how the roles people play in the family dynamic can change over time, depending on circumstances. The brothers are sort of dealing with life after the death of their father. It's left them a bunch of financial difficulties. Their house is sort of falling down around them. And Thad, especially the older brother, feels like he needs to sort of bear this responsibility while keeping his younger, more impulsive brother sort of in check, if you will. So I guess for me, I mean, there is sort of a thriller-esque element with the heist in Yellowstone Park, but when it comes down to it, it's about sort of the relationship the brothers have.
This book is called Beartooth After the Mountains that we see in the book. And you really transported me to these vistas, to this beautiful piece of Montana, to Yellowstone. Could you read a passage from the book so we can take our listeners there too?
Sure. A short passage here that I think captures some of the sort of the environment the story is set in, the area around Yellowstone National Park, that sort of thing. There was something about nature that was twice told. The human vascular system resembled the drainages of mountains, resembled the branching prongs of a lightning strike, resembled the xylem and phloem of trees from roots all the way to the lacework veins of the leaves. It was something Thad had thought about, but had never been able to pin down. In the fall, the red and gold and copper of the streamside alders and cottonwoods and willows were reflected in the spawning colors of the brown trout. It was almost enough to instill some sort of faith in a creator, some sort of guiding hand, an artist with a limited palette. Things were so remarkably similar when it seemed like they should be more different. When stripped of hide and hair, a bare skeleton looked eerily like a human form. The colors of certain sunsets were the colors of fire devouring wood. The sparks sent up to the sky, perfect replicas of stars. Maybe it meant something, maybe it didn't. The human mind was a register of patterns. Whether or not these patterns existed outside the brain itself was another matter altogether.
That's a beautiful passage. Thanks for reading. It really shows that you have some major connection to the land, to Montana. You know this land. Can you talk about that connection? Why Montana?
Yeah, I mean, I was born in Michigan, but I moved to Montana, I think, when I was 19 or so for a fishing guide job, something I've been doing ever since, really. I'm a fishing guide first and a writer second. So I work on the Yellowstone River primarily, a few other rivers as well. But, you know, I work all summer, spring, summer, fall on the river. So I'm out in the mountains on the river every day for my job. And quite honestly, it's a lot more fun than writing. So I'll probably keep it that way for a while. But just being immersed in it for so long, I mean, and being, you know, semi-observant, I think that stuff's just going to keep coming out in my writing for sure.
So you love the land. You clearly love being out there, and you still feel this need to write, even though it's not as fun as being on the river. So what is it that you want to put on the page? What do you want us to be seeing from this?
You know, I think if anything, I want to capture Montana as I experience and know it. Montana seems to be sort of a trendy place to make you know, films and TV series these days that maybe don't always accurately capture what it is like to live in Montana. So that's one thing. But I think the West in general is just such a great backdrop for story. I've always said that it's like fish in a tank, right? They grow to a certain size depending on the size of the tank. There's so much wide open space here. I sometimes feel like people's sort of personalities and characters tend to sort of become outsized as well. There's a lot of great stories to be had floating around amongst the people I know and meet even in passing out here. So as long as I'm living in Montana, I'll be trying to write down some of the stories I come across.
And this book is centered on two brothers who are living in a cabin. They're basically off the grid. And I'm dying to ask you, is it a real cabin?
No, definitely not. But sort of I had in mind a place on the sort of upper Yellowstone right before it comes out of Yellowstone Park that I sort of had in mind as where this cabin would be. But the cabin itself is a fabrication. Yeah.
In some ways, the Montana that you write about in this book, Beartooth, is a huge, scary wilderness. There's a lot to fear. And I couldn't really decide, like, did you want us to feel that fear? Or was there a comfort in it? Or was it both at once? How did you think about that as you were writing Beartooth?
In writing about the natural world, I guess I wanted to sort of do my best to portray the fact that the wilderness isn't scary or friendly or anything. It doesn't care about our human, you know, emotions. It just is. And so it can seem scary when you're to us, but it is, you know, its own entity that is not super concerned with human emotions. So it's, I think probably some people are drawn to it for that fact. Same with the ocean or anything that seems larger than us.
So you say that outsized personalities, outsized stories come out of that part of America and that part of Montana. And this book is really centered on a caper. And we'll dig into the caper in a little bit, but was any of this based on anything real, or is this all your imagination?
This is one of those things that, you know, like I've probably spent more time than I should have in the bars of southwestern Montana. And I feel like at one point, you know, I was talking to somebody at a bar somewhere and this sort of situation came up. I don't know if it ever actually happened, but essentially the story as I heard it was somebody back in the day packed a raft into the backcountry of Yellowstone Park and floated out after, you know, gathering some elk antlers. All of that is very illegal. And I don't actually know if that ever happened because you can't boat on the upper Yellowstone in Yellowstone Park. So I always liked the idea of it. You know, I love the Yellowstone River and I've floated as much of it as you can almost in terms of my trout fishing that I do. But that section in the park is always this sort of forbidden land, you know, that I look at and wish I could take a raft down. So if I can't do it in real life, I thought it would be fun to do it in a novel.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. My guest today is Callan Wink, and we are talking about his brand new novel, Beartooth. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. Callan, I really want to dig into these characters now. We've got this amazing caper, this big plan that these two brothers are going to float down the river with a huge pile of treasure of elk antlers, which is completely illegal, as you said. But let's start by digging into these two brothers. Who are they? Can you talk to us about Thad and Hazen?
Yeah. So Thad and Hazen, they're close in age, separated by about a year, in their late 20s. I think some people that I've talked to after reading it, they sort of characterize them as like, you know, off the grid or survivalists or whatever. And it maybe is a little that, but they're more kind of based on people I know in the area I live that just, you know, they tend to hunt for most of their meat. They are probably a little more, you know, in tune to what's going on in the outdoors than the average, but they do have electricity in their house. But basically, as I mentioned before, their father has recently died, and this house that he's left them is sort of crumbling due to the elements. The roof leaking is sort of a reoccurring thread in the novel, where it's just like weighing on Thad. But the relationship the brothers have is one, you know, I never had a brother. I always wanted one. I had two sisters, as it turns out, but some of my friends growing up were sort of like this close in age with a brother. And, you know, I grew up going over there and playing football in the yard or whatever. And it would always result in like a fist fight within 5 minutes, you know, between the brothers. And I always kind of like wanted that, you know, because, you know, at heart, they always were always there for each other, you know, even though they were constantly fighting. And so that sort of comes up in the relationship between these two brothers. Probably the main point of strain between them, I would say, is Hazen is maybe, you know, I didn't want him to be a character you could slap like an easy diagnosis on. I didn't want you to read it and be like, oh, Hazen has this. He just doesn't quite fit in as well, maybe, to some of the sort of constraints of modern society as it is. And is also prone to sort of rash decision-making at times. And so I think Thad has this sort of normal older sibling feeling like he needs to sort of keep his younger brother in line and look out for him. And much of how the characters develop over the novel is sort of dealing with that issue, you know, as the novel progresses, maybe Thad's feelings on his brother have changed and maybe Hazen has become somewhat independent out from his brother's shadow.
You really strip down their lives. You've put them in this family home that they've inherited, but it's literally falling apart. The roof is leaking. The whole house needs upgrades or it needs to be repaired so that it doesn't just fall down. And then in addition, they're basically alone and they have no money and they're buried in debt. What are these two brothers going to do? You really put them in this horrible position. And I'm just imagining you writing this book and being like, what else can I take away? What else can I take away? Is that how you thought about it?
In part. I mean, I think the financial difficulty, the sort of living very close to the edge is something I wanted to capture here because it's really like not that far away from a lot of people's experiences here and all over the country in places in rural America, especially where one unexpected repair bill on a car can send your whole life into this tailspin that you can't get out from underneath. And when you're faced with that sort of thing, your maybe sort of ethical high ground you've been standing on about certain things may start to somewhat crumble out from underneath you, and you realize you're willing to do things you would not necessarily have thought you would do in order to just, for instance, be able to put gas in your car or fix your roof or eat, you know?
Yeah. Okay, so then enter another character, the Scott. And you bring him in, right? He's sort of the guy who brings in this idea that maybe there's a way out for you. Would you mind reading his description when we first meet him?
Okay. Now the Scott walked toward them, a smile on his big raw-boned face. He was unusually tall, closer to 7 feet than six. There were rumors that he'd been on a professional basketball team in the 70s. His kilt was red and black Highland plaid. He wore tall wool socks and black thick-soled boots. A white button-down dress shirt tucked into the kilt, a thin black tie with a tie clip shaped like a thistle. He wore his pistol in a shoulder holster, and it looked small there against his massive frame, a toy pistol. The Scot was weathered in a way that made determining his age impossible. He looked younger than 65, older than 40. His hands always reminded Thad of those huge, hairy tropical spiders, the kind that are the size of dinner plates and hunt birds. He had a shock of red hair going gray at the temples. His arms were long and still corded with muscle, his joints too big, hard, and gnarled like abnormal growths in dense hardwood.
So the Scot, he doesn't seem like he fits in with these brothers in Montana. He's literally the Scot, not even the American.
Yeah.
And he comes in and the brothers, they're desperate. They don't know what they're going to do. And he says, I have this idea for you. I've got this way that we can make money. You'll have everything you need covered. Tell us about the caper.
Yeah. So the Scot approaches them. You know, they had done a little work for him in the past, work being, you know, illegal poaching of animals to make ends meet. He has this plan that they could make a bunch of money gathering elk antlers, which is actually a pretty popular and common activity here. Shed elk antlers actually go for quite a bit of money, and it's just like a hobby people have. However, it's very illegal to gather them in Yellowstone National Park, and there's a lot of them there. If you've ever hiked around in Yellowstone Park, you'll see them, and you will get in a lot of trouble if you pick one up and remove it. So he and the brothers disagree on whether or not this is even feasible, and Thad definitely resists for a long time until certain circumstances arise that make Thad actually decide to do it. But the Scot is a character, you know, he's kind of fun to write. I grew up around bagpipes. My father played the bagpipes when I was a kid. The Scot is not based on my father. My father's a great guy, not a villain. But I grew up sort of loving the bagpipes. As I got older, I realized that not everyone shares my affinity for the bagpipes, and that a lot of people think they're like sort of horrendous things to listen to. But I think it's like a funny sort of prop for a villain to cart around in Montana as a bagpipe and a kilt. So the Scot is sort of this shadowy, menacing figure in the book. I don't know if you've ever read Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, but it's one of my favorite books, and it has maybe the best all-time bad guy in any literary novel I can think of in The Judge. And the Scot is definitely channeling a little bit of The Judge, for sure.
You know, it surprises me that you're calling the Scot the villain, because I spent the book thinking, is he bad? I mean, he's offering a way out. Talk to me about that. Is he a villain?
Well, I never wanted him to be just like a two-dimensional villain. Like everyone in the novel, he's has more than one side to him, for sure. He's not probably a villain. I don't know. I think it's just like an easy way to describe what he does for the novel. But he's probably not a great guy. You know, he is definitely shot and killed someone in his living room who was breaking into his house. You know, again, sort of a gray area there. But, you know, what he adds to the story is this element of unsavoriness. He's sort of the brother's connection to the underworld of selling illegal animal parts on the black market, essentially.
So this blew my mind, because I had just never really read much about selling illegal animal parts on the black market or theft out of Yellowstone. That was a whole new world for me. Can you talk to me about that? How big of a problem is that in Montana?
I mean, the elk antlers in the park, it's a pretty common thing. And mostly that like tourists coming that just, I mean, even though there's signs everywhere, I mean, there's people that still try to pet the bison and things like that. So reading of signs is not a big thing that happens in Yellowstone Park, but almost every year someone gets in trouble for trying to take elk antlers home. Usually not like a large scale operation, but just like one or two because they think they look cool. But, you know, there's been a number of sort of high profile in Montana poaching cases, usually people trying to shoot like trophy elk and things like that when they don't have the right tag or out of season and that sort of thing. But yeah, there is a market for especially bear gallbladders, essentially, you know, that I'm imagining sent to an Asian market. Yeah.
Yeah, you put that in the book, and it was just something that I had never thought of, which is another thing that I just loved about this book, because it really opened me up to all these things happening out there that I just had not imagined. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. And my guest today is Callan Wink. We're talking about his brand new novel, Beartooth. And we are just in the middle of talking about this grand caper. These two brothers, Thad and Hazen, are living in Montana on the edge of Yellowstone. They are buried under debt. They don't know what they're going to do. And then the Scott comes in, this character who says, I have an idea. Go into Yellowstone and steal 100 pairs of antlers for me. Erase all of your problems. We're going to sell them on the black market and you'll be set for life, or at least set for now. And so the brothers have this big question in front of them. Should they go and steal the antlers out of Yellowstone, which is completely illegal? And one of the things that this brings up is, what are you willing to do to save your brother, to save your family, to save the house that you've lived in your entire life? Can you talk to us about that, that feeling of desperation and what someone is willing to do in order to save themselves or their family?
Yeah, I mean, I think both the brothers, Thad and Hazen, you know, they're not heroic figures in any way. I mean, I wanted them to be very much just sort of like normal guys who are sort of pushed into this situation. I mean, they don't have a lot of other marketable skills. You know, they've been kind of eking out a living, cutting firewood, delivering firewood, that sort of thing. And, you know, this is a way for them to at least for a while escape some crushing debt that they have. I mean, they're not only is the house falling down, they're facing possibly losing it. You know, their father had incurred a lot of medical bills, like many people I know, underinsured or not insured at all, you know? And yeah, I mean, the circumstances of this seem fairly, at least to me in places I've been in my life, it seems fairly believable and recognizable. In fact, slightly dramatized for the purposes of novel and story, but I think a lot of people are forced to make hard decisions based on financial difficulty. And what they end up doing is, it definitely seems a little kind of extreme and out there, but for the life they've lived and what they've been raised in, the undertaking that they go about in Yellowstone Park probably doesn't seem as foreign or daunting as it would to someone who'd lived, you know, in New York City their whole life.
So we're focused on these two brothers, Thad and Hazen, and we've talked about the Scott. And at one point, one of them makes this comment that they really live in Mantana, not Montana. I thought that was a funny way to think about it. But there are women in this book also. Enter Thad and Hazen's mom. She shows up in this beaten down van. Introduce us to her.
Yeah, so their mother is had been an absent figure for much of their growing up. She had tragedy of her own in her life and had the brothers at a fairly young age, and, you know, probably didn't have the greatest, most fulfilling relationship with their father. And as a result, sort of set off on a journey of her own and left the brothers in the care of their father. So her sudden return, you know, the brothers deal with that differently. Thad, the older brother, carries a lot more resentment, and much of his growth as a character is him sort of coming to terms with his mother and maybe accepting her a little more for who she is by the end of the book. You know, the house actually, although it was sort of left to them by their father, is her childhood home. It was built by her father. And so the land that it's on, I mean, that was where she grew up. Although Thad feels like it's his now, he has to wrestle with the fact that it actually is still hers, and she has kind of a right to be there, even though he's not real accepting of her.
Yeah, and it really brings up this question of, do you love your family or do you owe your family something? Thad doesn't want her there. He wants to kick her off, but not really, because it's his mom.
Yeah, exactly. He, as a young person, was deeply hurt by his mother leaving, you know, and he didn't understand why. And now that he's an adult, that hurt is just transferred into, you know, anger, basically. And I think by the end, he has maybe a different stance, has come to a different stance. Yeah.
Right. Because a little bit of what they're searching for is not just literally cash to pay off all of your debts, but also where they belong in this world. And part of that is, where does their mom fit? Who do they love? Who do they owe? That kind of question. And this brings us to another female character, which of course is the Scott's daughter, who may or may not be his daughter, this sort of younger woman who tags along. Talk to us about her for a minute too.
Yeah, she is another sort of character. I mean, she's maybe not incredibly central to the plot as it is, but she's sort of along with the Scott for much of the book, as she's a bit of a mystery to Thad, especially. He doesn't quite know where she came from, or he assumes it's the Scott's daughter, but as things develop in the book, he realizes that may not actually be the case. I think what this character Naomi does in the book, she's sort of a counterpoint and adds some resonance to the figure of their mother in the novel. The two of them have this connection that becomes more important. And also Hazen as well. He kind of does a severe rash act there towards the end involving the Scott. And the impetus, the catalyst for that in many ways is this young woman.
So with the brothers, there's family love, there's devotion, there's what do you owe your mom? But then when you bring in the Scott's daughter, Naomi, you have this question of, could there be romantic love? And Hazen thinks maybe he loves her. And it felt like this was just sort of your moment where you could say, what is love in this book? And trying to explore emotions a little bit further. Is that how you were thinking about her?
Yeah, I think as I was writing, I mean, much of what I was interested in was the relationship with the brothers, and Hazen needed to gain some kind of independence. And in this one area, it's an area where Thad was sort of, he thought he kind of knew everything about his brother, basically. I mean, grown up closely together. And then all of a sudden, there's this moment where Hazen sort of goes off on his own and has this attraction for this woman that Thad sort of has a hard time wrapping his head around, like how his brother could even, you know, he's not the sort that probably had been on a lot of dates in high school, put it that way. So it sort of seems surprising that and definitely made him look at his brother in a different way, as more of an independent person than he'd maybe ever seen him before.
And what it really did was it focused on this idea of what is love versus this sort of what we'll call caretaking, I guess, because I think that you really point to that in the book. And actually, there's a passage that I love that talked about this. Can you read for us?
Yeah, sure, I'd love to. Thad had started to walk away, but he stopped. He wiped at his running nose and spit into the snow at his feet. I've noticed a strange thing in those who serve as caretakers, the Scot said. They tend to underestimate the abilities of their charges. The more someone needs your care, the more important your own existence becomes. What are you trying to say? I'm saying that you'd be uncomfortable if your brother didn't rely on you. If your brother set off on his own, Thad, what would you do with yourself?
And that, for me, was really the center of this book or this relationship between the two brothers. Do they need each other? What would they be without one another?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the Scott as a character has this ability. He sees that and he's able to play it against Thad, especially. He has this sort of insight into the relationship the brothers have, and he uses that to get what he wants, which is he wants the brothers to go do this thing in the park. If it was just Thad probably would have said no, but you know, he approached Hazen, the younger brother, with the proposition, and knowing Thad's sort of relationship to Hazen, he knew that that would get Thad involved, whether he really wanted to or not.
If you're just joining us, I'm Rachel Barenbaum. My guest today is Callan Wink, and you're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. We're talking about the brand new novel, Beartooth. We are in Montana, we're in the wilderness, and we are just on the edge of Yellowstone Park. We're talking about two brothers, Thad and Hazen. They're in their late 20s. And the big question is, do they love each other? Do they need each other? Is there really a difference? Or what can they be without one another? And I thought that's really what this book looked into, really pried into. But it also took us into life in Montana and what it's like to live in the backwoods. And these two brothers, in trying to save each other, have a horrible accident on the river when they are in the midst of trying to steal a bunch of elk antlers and take them out of Yellowstone Park. Can you talk about that accident and where that lands, Thad, for us?
Yeah, so they're in the process of, you know, it's like all good adventures, they have a moment where they think they've gotten away with it. And, you know, disaster ensues. Thad, they're kind of lining a raft down a section of river that they can't run safely. And he slips and falls and breaks his arm really badly on a rock. forcing the younger brother, Hazen, to do something that is sort of out of his nature, out of the nature of their relationship. Hazen has to kind of take control of the situation and see this thing through to the end, because Thad is incapacitated after that. So that moment is sort of a catalyst for a lot of what comes next. Hazen probably gains some sort of sense of autonomy from that event.
So at the same time as Hazen sort of rises up, we see Thad start to fall. And this point in the book, Thad, his life is in danger. He has to go to the hospital and he becomes addicted to opioids. And this was the point in the book that really took me to a specific moment in time. Before, we could have been at any time in American history, but we're centered on opioids. We know where we are because there's no real internet. There's no real cell phone before this. Not really. But now we know exactly where we are in the middle of the opioid crisis. And you take us into the depths, the horrors, the hardship of addiction. Talk about that and opioids and what that is doing in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty common narrative now, especially if you've spent a decent amount of time in rural America. It's still an ongoing problem, obviously, especially when I was growing up in my early 20s. It was just such a big thing. And how many people who sort of slipped into that as a result of some kind of injury or surgery, you know, like it was kind of amazing. I personally have known a few people. It wasn't like they were these sort of hardened drug people that just found a new way to get high or something. It was like they literally went to the doctor and got prescribed these things, and then it sort of sent their life down this tailspin. Yeah, that was, you know, something that definitely seemed like was true to the characters and the place and time, and a very sort of common thing that has happened to a lot of people.
And through this drug addiction, the brothers are sort of fighting their way through, I'm going to say, trying to figure out, you know, what's the next step? Are they going to lose the house? Are they going to lose the land? And their mom is this presence in there, too. So can you talk to us about how that family of three is dealing with it?
Yeah, I mean, that part of the book, that's sort of Thad's low point for sure. And there is this thing when you're at your absolute lowest, you know, it becomes harder to maybe hold on to a grudge or, you know, stick to your guns about how you feel about someone in particular. This is his mother. You know, he's laid completely low. And at that point, you know, a lot of the anger and resentment sort of probably starts to fade away a little under just all the other things he's going through. He doesn't have place in his life to hate his mother as much as he had before when he was, you know, healthy and capable of doing what he wanted to do, more or less. So the act of becoming extremely, you know, weak and sort of dependent in a way on a drug and then other people sort of probably recalibrated some of his feelings towards his relationship with his mother.
So early on in the book, you have this great line that I absolutely loved. And you say that it's sort of advice that Thad got from his father. And his father said, "Be comfortable. People who are comfortable in their own skin can never get lost." And in a way, I thought a lot of this book was about getting lost. But then drugs, or opioids in particular, when you're recovering from an injury, I kept asking myself, was he lost? Or was it not his fault, right? Because he took these pills because the doctor said you should take these pills. But then he's spiraling down and can't find his way back up. So I just wanted to ask you about that, you know, this idea that people who are comfortable in their own skin can never get lost, and how that pertains to this addiction section.
I think that particular line from his father would apply really well to the brother's life spent sort of in the mountains of Montana. They're not the sort to worry too much about getting lost in the backcountry. The things that their father taught them growing up did not necessarily apply well to other areas in your life where you can get lost, and the things that happen to you when you're not in the woods, you're in town, you're at the doctor's office, you're dealing with, you know, something like a bank statement or a medical bill, that sort of thing. And how the things you're taught as a young person, you know, sort of guide what you do in your life. Thad and Hazen, neither of them were very well educated on
on these other things that are just, you know, the cost of doing business in modern society.
So while Thad is in the middle of this drug-induced haze, he's spiraling down. Hazen is finding himself. He's getting a car. He's getting a job. He's really finding his own independence. But he's also spending time at the bar, and he's talking about this big caper and what they did. And he's spinning a legend. And I would love it if you could read to us a little bit about this.
Okay. You haven't been to town much this winter, have you? You two have become quite the folk heroes. Ran the canyons and stashed the goods. Outlaws. They'll be singing ballads about you before long. We didn't stash anything. And that's not all. There's some people saying that you found something up there, a valuable something, that you're just biding your time until you can go back and get it. What are you even talking about? We had a decent load of antlers that we scrounged around all over the damn place to get. We tossed them in the river. End of story. The park is a mysterious place, the Scot said. I don't need to tell you that. Geological oddities, early human inhabitation, the remains of extinct animals. I've read up on it. Did you know that they found the skulls of ancient rhinoceroses in the park? Mammoth tusks and gold, of course.
I love this section because now not only was there this caper, but it's turned into a legend. And the locals are all saying, what did the brothers really find? Did they stash something? Was there ever this kind of legend? Was this based on anything real?
No, but the area around where I live, it does sort of abound in these, you know, you can find things, you know, and there's a good portion of the local population that spends time looking for stuff. Either they want to sell it or they just want to collect. There's all sorts of places you can go to find ancient artifacts, arrowheads, spear points, that sort of thing. It's fairly common when the river, you know, we get a very large runoff on the Yellowstone River every year and banks erode. Ancient bison skulls will poke out now and again, all sorts of things. And also the gold. I mean, there's a fairly major discovery of gold, an emigrant not far from where I live. So people still pan for gold in the small streams around here. So all that stuff is very much a part of the lore of this part of Montana.
Callan, in your book, Beartooth, your character Thad thinks a lot about his father. And at one point, he wonders if his father came from stronger stuff. That's actually what he says. You know, maybe his father came from stronger stuff. Can you talk about that and maybe what he meant by that?
Most likely, I think Thad probably, like many of us, considers himself maybe not living up to the standards of his father, for right or wrong. And being the oldest born son, he probably feels a responsibility to sort of, you know, carry on whatever legacy his father has left him, for better or worse. You know, I think probably there is it's kind of a common theme or trope is always sort of, you know, the generation before, you know, the greatest generation is an example, seem to have some sort of gumption, if you will, that this may be lacking now. And I think it's just probably a common thought to have, you know, as a son thinking about his father and how he stands up, you know.
Is there something in specific you think that haunts Thad about his father that makes him think about that again and again, that maybe his father came from stronger stuff?
You know, it's really easy to put someone who's died on a pedestal that maybe they didn't deserve in real life, you know, when Thad's father has died. And so, you know, never again will he see his father, you know, fail at something he's tried to do or, you know, prove that he in fact, you know, was made of the same stuff as everyone else, you know. So when someone dies, there's a possibility that other people, in this case Thad, you know, mythologize them a little bit.
Callan, as I read Beartooth, I got the feeling that there were ghosts, different kinds of ghosts in your book and haunting the brothers. And you actually say at one point, you have this passage, at her age, the balance must shift, the weight of memory gathering mass until each waking day was more of a waking dream, haunted by the shades of people you'd known who were a long time gone. And I love this idea of memories haunting us and weighing us down. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone alive has memories of their past, and those influence then how they move through their life, you know. Probably those things increase the older you get, and when you're confronting the fact that maybe your time on Earth is coming to an end, you have more inclination to go back and relive the things that you've done. Seems like probably a pretty common, you know, situation that you find yourself in as you age.
My guest today is Callan Wink. We're talking about his brand new novel, Beartooth. I'm Rachel Barenbaum. You're listening to Check This Out from New Hampshire Public Radio. This book was amazing. I could not stop reading it. It took me to the outskirts of Yellowstone, to rural Montana, and into the lives of two brothers, Thad and Hazen, who are absolutely down and out, have nothing going for them, and think they can save everything through this amazing caper. You have to read the book to find out if it works out, but there was a lot involved. There were a lot of subplots, little details going on in this book. And then I read that Callan started this book as a novella, that it was actually even shorter. Callan, did this start as a novella? How did that happen?
Yeah, this one had a long, sort of a long trajectory to get to where it's at. The premise of the novel I've had for over 10 years. I think it actually started as a short story when I was in grad school many years ago in Wyoming. You know, some of the characters, kind of the premise of the going into the park to get the antlers, that was always there. Then I turned it into a really long, boring novel. It was one of my early novel attempts. It was kind of bloated and long. It lost its way very quickly, and it was not very good. And I put it away for many years and wrote, you know, two other books in the meantime. And then a couple years ago, I went back to it just because I still liked the premise and I liked the characters. And I just sort of severely cut it down, edited it, just took out everything that was boring. And then I had what I thought was a pretty good novella, 80, 90 pages, something like that. And I had this idea that I was going to publish a collection of novellas. And turns out publishers don't know what to do with a collection of novellas. Several of them liked it, but they were like, I don't know if we can sell this, but we like this one, this Beartooth one. Can you turn this one into a novel? And so I'm like, all right, we've come full circle now. And I expanded it. It's still a short novel, but it is now a novel. Yeah. So it's gone a couple different revolutions in its life.
I'm so glad you shared that, because I think a lot of readers think that books come out as these perfectly crafted pieces, but they go through so many iterations and years of work.
Yeah, exactly. I think the longer I do this, the more I realize how much work it is. It's actually everyone gets a little harder because you kind of know what you're getting into when you start. And you're like, oh, man, I don't know if I have what it takes to see this one through to the end. It's going to be years. But yeah.
So you are a river guide. You've talked about that a little bit, and you live in Montana. But these brothers, Thad and Hazen, they are really survivalists. They are living on the land. They're chopping wood. They're hunting. They're doing all this. Did you already know how to do all of this, or did you have to go out and learn some of these things that they're doing in the book?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, I do not have what the brothers have in terms of outdoor savvy and sort of live off the land mentality. But, you know, I did grow up hunting and fishing, and you know, I've cut my share of firewood in my day. And so, I mean, these things are not like foreign to me. I can't say I did a lot of research, but in particular, I don't do much hunting anymore. That is something that I have a lot of friends that are the guide elk hunters and hunt a lot. So, you know, just being around the people I'm around, you sort of pick up these details that then, you know, you can insert into the narrative to give yourself some authenticity. But it's stuff I've been around my whole life, really. So it didn't seem all that like foreign to me.
Do you keep a notebook or something to remind you of these little stories or things that you pick up when you're out there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always trying to write stuff down so I don't forget. You know, little things come to you at random times, and it is easy to just forget them. So I'm always scribbling stuff down. Yeah.
And your novel, this book, Beartooth, is fiction, but I understand you write a lot of personal essays.
I write some personal essays. Most of those these days are sort of outdoor / fishing kind of lifestyle magazines. There's a great publication called Angler's Journal that publishes really good writing and photography, and I write for them fairly frequently.
Mm-hmm. And how different is it to write those personal essays versus a novel?
Quite a bit different. Yeah, it's nice though. I mean, it's nice to just finish something in a decent amount of time. So the short form is something that I used to love to do. I used to write a lot of short stories, but it can be hard to find much success publishing short stories these days. So I kind of moved away from it, but the essay thing, it still allows me to, you know, begin something and end it in a reasonable amount of time and see it in print. You know, it's kind of nice. There's long periods of time between the publishing of books, at least for me. So it kind of keeps me in the game a little bit. You know, a paycheck every now and again is nice as well.
And it's nice to just see your words get out there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you are a river guide. You spend a lot of time on the rivers and outside, but you write also, of course. That's why we're here, to talk about your brand new novel, Beartooth. And you have an MFA. So you've gone to school for this too, and yet your real heart is on the river. So I'm just dying to ask you about that pull between the MFA versus being a guide, being outside. Sort of how do you see those two working together?
Yeah, I mean, in a lot of ways, writing has never seemed like really a job to me, like a career, definitely not a career. It's something that I was very fortunate with, the writing, but I went to got my MFA at the University of Wyoming, and it was, for me going in, I was fishing guiding at the time, and it was something I could do in the winter for a couple of years, and I knew I would write a lot and have some people read my stuff, and then I would go back and be a fishing guide after. And that was all I ever thought of it. And that was going to be it. And luckily, while I was there, I had some great, great teachers and mentors. Brad Watson in particular was one of them. And long story short, I got a short story in the New Yorker when I was there. And that sort of changed my life in terms of I got a book deal out of that. And then I was kind of like, well, now I kind of have to do this. But yeah, always still fishing guiding. I mean, that is how I make my money. Writing is certainly not keeping me afloat. So, and I love it. I mean, I've never wanted to, I've done a little teaching and I've enjoyed it. But I couldn't see myself, you know, being the university writing professor. I'd rather fishing guide, quite honestly, and be outside and just kind of make my own schedule and be in the boat. I love doing it, so.
But I just have to back up for a minute and go back to this little thing that you dropped, that when you were getting your MFA, you got a story in the New Yorker, and that changed your life. Like, yes, it did. That does not just happen. So tell us for a minute about that.
Yeah, so I mentioned Brad Watson, who just passed away, actually, a couple years ago, unfortunately. But a tremendous writer and a great writing teacher and a really, really generous with his time. He was there and I was in a writing workshop with him. And he liked a couple of my stories and just, you know, sent them to his agent in New York, and his agent sent one to the New Yorker, and they eventually took it. So it was very surprising. And like I said, it turned into a two book contract, when really I was 27 and I had written about four short stories. So, it was a little sort of, I had to figure out how to do it. I'm still figuring it out. You know, I don't really have a formula for writing the novel. Every time I manage to finish one, it seems like a tremendous surprise. So maybe it's not that way for everyone, but that's how it is for me.
So what advice do you have for new writers?
You know, this is something that I'll steal from Brad, that he always used to say. I think it was from Isak Dennison, who said, write a little each day without hope and without despair. So that's kind of what I try to do.
I love that. Callan Wink, thank you so much for joining me today here on Check This Out.
Thank you for having me, Rachel. It's fun.
I'm Rachel Barenbaum, author of the novel Atomic Anna. You've been listening to Check This Out, where we dive deeply into the works of emerging and diverse authors you may not have discovered yet. This conversation is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Penn Faulkner Foundation. The Penn Faulkner Foundation administers major literary awards and public programs, including the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. I'll be back next week with Julie Iromagna. We'll be talking about her new novel, A Season of Light. Make sure to check this out. Our producer today is NHPR's Jessica Hunt. Penn Faulkner's executive director is Gwydion Sullivan. NHPR's program director is Emily Quirk. The show is sponsored by CNS Wholesale Grocers Family of Companies, the podcast Totally Booked with Zibby, the Jack and Dorothy Byrne Foundation, and the Howe Library Corporation. Remember to go to your local library or local bookstore and check out all the books you hear about, hear, and love. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next time.